Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here, and welcome to my house for our almost weekly fireside chat, which begins with music and cigars, two of my great loves of life. So let's tune up the music, get the orchestra going. Is it going? There we go. How many of you know what it is? One. Great. This is the third movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Classical music has been my friend since high school. I discovered it doing listening to at Carnegie Hall. I grew up in New York City, and I had a ticket for $1 because they gave tickets to high school students for $1. It's amazing. And it was love at first hearing. I got so involved in it, I taught myself how to conduct, and I believe this year I'll be conducting at the biggest hall in Los Angeles, the Walt Disney. So I love it, and I love this too. So it's a great combination. I'm a sort of hedonist. I really do love joy. All right, guys, anyway, let me just tell you one thing about a symphony. It's a piece for orchestra. Not all pieces for orchestra are symphonies, but all symphonies are pieces for a whole orchestra. They usually come in four movements. Beethoven wrote 9 of them, arguably the greatest 9, and that was the 7th. So welcome. A big news item today in the media, and that is Fox News announced that they were letting Bill O'Reilly go. And I assume nearly all of you are familiar with him. He's the biggest name in cable news. He was the star. They're letting him go because the New York Times reported that just a few weeks ago that Bill O'Reilly and or Fox had paid out millions and millions of dollars in 5 different cases of women charging Bill O'Reilly with sexual harassment. And I have a few things to say. One of them is, it's not about O'Reilly. I'll get back to O'Reilly, but I'm taking the big macro picture. When was the last time you heard of a woman paying out money because she was sued by a man for sexual harassment? I want you to think about it for a moment while I puff. Now, you realize I could smoke this entire cigar and you still wouldn't come up with a name. And it takes about, I'd say, 2 hours to smoke this whole cigar. I've never heard of it in my life. Have you? Of a woman paying out money for sexual harassment of a man. How come women don't sexually harass men? Of course, there's a very simple answer. Because women and men are so different. But beginning when I was in college in the late 60s, early 70s, the moronic notion, truly moronic, I mean, it is, you talk about anti-science, you can't get more anti-science than the notion that men and women are basically the same. It's anti-science, it's anti all the evidence of all of history combined. Men and women are different, and men have a burden. Both sexes have burdens. Well, we each have different burdens. Each sex has different burdens. And while it's not true for every single member of either sex, it's true for the vast majority. The sexual nature of men is a burden. It is so powerful, and it is so variety-oriented, and so easily started, aroused, if you will, that it is something men have to battle at all times. I'll never forget a friend of mine in high school who was not quite a party goer. He was as straight as a guy could be, and I don't mean straight heterosexual. He was heterosexual, but I mean just straight. You know, no narcotics, no drugs, no alcohol, He was interested, you know, in just having a girlfriend and having a warm relationship, which is lovely, obviously, but not much more than that. I mean, he wanted sexual things too, but in other words, he was not a wild guy. And he came over to me one day and said, "You know, Dennis, I was thinking about it, and I was talking to some of the guys in the class, and it occurred to me, here is my discovery. One out of every 10 thoughts a guy has is not about sex." And that was brilliant. It was just a brilliant insight. And there's virtually no woman living who could relate to that. That's not where women's minds are. Now, women have their own burdens, as I said. Women and their hormones and women and their emotions. They have their own set of life issues to deal with. But in the sexual arena, it's a tough one for men. And I've said on my male female hour, and if you don't hear it, I do a radio show I have for 35 years, and it's a daily show. It's all over the country. It's on the internet as well. There's a Dennis Prager app. It's easy to hear it. Every Wednesday, the second hour of my show is called the male female hour. And if you are either a male or a female, you will learn a great deal from it, especially females. And it has saved a lot of marriages. People tell me that. And because I'm very honest about male sexuality, and believe it or not, I once recommended this to wives whose husbands are faithful. Every so often, maybe twice a year, tell them that you tell your husband, "You know, I know you're a hot-blooded guy, and I want you to know I respect you, and I am grateful to you for your fidelity." Now, a lot of women can't stand that. Can't stand what I just said. They're called feminists, and feminists are generally in denial of reality with regard to men and women. But that is a very beautiful thing to say to your husband, to realize that it's a true issue. I mean, Bill O'Reilly, if the charges are true, and one suspects, I don't know, obviously, one suspects that there's a large measure of truth, given that it was that number of women and the payouts. But whatever it is, he's not my concern as much as the issue is my concern. But just think about what Bill O'Reilly gave up because he was allegedly pressuring women to sleep with him. Think about it. Most prominent cable newsman in America, a terrific salary, tremendous fan base. Every book he wrote went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and gave it up because he couldn't control his sexual nature. You know how many men's lives have been ruined? A lot of women's lives have been ruined too by male sexual nature, there's no question. But I'm just talking about from the men's part. It's a very powerful, it's the life force, and it's something that is not easily controlled. And that's what I thought. I just thought, there goes another one. And, you know, President Clinton. I mean, think of that. The man was almost driven out of office because he couldn't control himself in that arena. You know, he's 8-year presidency. And, you know, I'll never forget, and I didn't like him. But I don't dislike him as much as I dislike his wife, I have to say that. But I'm not a fan of his, but I don't have any great hatred either for him. And never did. But I'll never forget Billy Graham, the most well-known Christian in the United States at the time, this major evangelical preacher. And he was like the sort of unofficial chaplain of like 7-8 presidents. So, and he's considered a conservative, but it didn't matter. Democratic presidents solicited his advice as well. And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, "You know, before any man judges this man, or anyone judges him, that is Bill Clinton, they should be in his shoes. Because the opportunities that he had to have women are far, far greater than the opportunities that the average man has. And who knows how the average man, who is now not unfaithful, but has no real ability to be unfaithful, or at least not nearly as much as a president of the United States would, because fame and power are aphrodisiacs to women, just as looks are an aphrodisiac to a man. So I just wanted to put it in perspective. I don't have any more insight into the O'Reilly affair than any of you listening. But I do have insight into the human condition, and that's what I wanted to share with you, reflections on that aspect of the human condition, that burden that men have till they die. And which reminds me of a story. I think this batch of this cigar, I never have to light a cigar more than once. This is very strange for me. It's not packed well.
Try another one.
Mm-mm. It's all right. Very odd. A pipe I have to light a lot, but not a cigar. Anyway, it reminded me when I said, till you die. So a woman called my show many years ago. Female doctor. And she obviously didn't know my own views on the matter. And she said, you know, I just want to tell you, Dennis, I'll give you a story here. Men are impossible. I said, really? What makes you say that? She said, you know, I was with a man who was literally dying. He was in his 90s and he was dying. And one of the last things he did was that I noticed he was looking down my blouse. And I said to her, I'm sure she was not pleased with my reaction, said, well, I just want you to know, that's a good way to go out. He was one lucky dude. It's not the reaction she wanted. She wanted me to go, oh, that's disgusting. And I'm thinking, well, if you gotta leave this world, that's a nice final sight to have for a man. But that's how it is with men. And here's your choice if you're a woman. Really, here's your choice. You can spend your life denying it, and then you are an official feminist. Or you can accept the reality for what it is and laugh with your husband or your boyfriend about it. And that's the best, because then he doesn't have to hide who he is from you, which is a major source of marital tension, is when men have to hide who they are from their wives because they're embarrassed. God, to be embarrassed to say who you really are to your own spouse, that's sad. Okay. Some thoughts on a very, very important subject. And what I just told you, you will not hear in almost any class, in almost any university in the United States. Because you're not told about reality at college. It's a make-believe world that teaches you about a make-believe world. It's pretty sad. So we go to questions. Is that okay there, Jared? Okay, here we go. Oh, did everybody see Otto today? No? Any way to check out our bulldog Otto? He's sitting in the office with me. He's actually lying down. If you can get Otto's face, it is one of the joys of life to see Otto's face. Otto is, as you could see, Otto is troubled. I'm kidding. Otto is as untroubled a creature as exists higher than the rodent species. We got him. Back to me. Steven asks, what should our policy be vis-a-vis North Korea and China? Do you like what President Trump has been doing with them? Yes, I do. I love what he's been doing. Finally, the word is out that this psychopathological regime in North Korea cannot just build nuclear-tipped ICBMs, intercontinental, get that? Intercontinental ballistic missile. And if they can carry a nuclear warhead, he can, in fact, nuclear invade the west coast of the United States. But nothing has been done about him. And now, finally, there is a president who feels that something might be done. By the way, we may have a war with North Korea. I do believe that it is possible. However, I'd rather fight in North Korea than in Seattle. Well, now let me think about Seattle. Yeah, no, I'm kidding. I would rather a fight there than here. And I'd rather fight now than later when he has more of this stuff. Having said that, the greatest threat in the world today is not North Korea. It is a big one. It's Iran. But that's another story for another time. Okay. Joel asks, what can we do about the near universal idea that everyone has to go to college? Do you think everyone needs a college degree? If not, how do we change this widespread belief? I'm not sure I know of a more foolish belief. There must be one, but I can't think of it offhand, than everybody should go to college. The number of people I know who didn't go to college who are so bright, in part because they didn't go to college. See, I do believe, and I mean this literally, I never exaggerate. I kid around and so on, but I don't exaggerate. I do believe that for most people, not in the natural sciences, I mean, if you study botany and geology or chemistry or biology, physics, you know, it's a separate world. But if you were in what they call the social sciences, the liberal arts, whatever term they now use, the chances are you will leave more foolish than when you came in. It's sort of a BA in silliness. That's what you get. If you get a graduate degree in silliness, then you're really silly. Now, you may need it for some reason. Obviously, most people, well, just about everybody, has to go to medical school for medicine, but that's the natural sciences. But other than that, this has been a terribly pernicious belief, and I blame employers. I blame employers more than anyone else because they have jobs which absolutely don't necessitate a college degree. I would like to know what job necessitates a college degree. I'm not talking again about the natural sciences. I want to think about one. You want to hire someone in sales. What is a college degree? You got a BA in sociology or English or God forbid, women's studies, gender studies. Why are you qualified any better than anybody else for sales? Or give me another job, guys. I mean, what is a typical job that people will... I mean, there are so many different jobs. But I mean, think of something. I don't know what it's necessary for. You know, you would originally studied accounting. So you have to know accounting to get an accounting job. I recognize that.
And to work at PragerU.
To work at PragerU, we do not require a college degree. Wash your mouth out. That has never happened and will not happen as long as Prager is living. Any Prager. It's a terrible thing. And employers should never do that. I was just with Charlie Kirk of Turning Point. We're actually partnering with Turning Point to do work on campuses, more work on campuses. And Charlie Kirk is extremely bright and extremely deep. He's a powerful guy. I think he's 23 years old. Never went to college. And he now runs programs for thousands upon thousands of students at universities. It's a very bad idea that everybody has to go to college. Michaela asks, Dennis, I'm a 25-year-old single female who's dating for marriage. Already I like you. That is wise, Michaela. Do you have some general dating advice for me and anyone else who's looking to marry? Yeah. Mm-hmm. First, if you are seeing somebody, go to the internet and look up Dennis Prager. What is it? Questions you should ask. You remember what it was? Questions to ask before you marry. And I have, it's a two-part column I wrote many years ago. And I think it's 8 questions you should answer before you marry somebody. Now, that's not entirely directly answering a question, but it is something I wrote that will be helpful. A lot of people wrote me who were dating, even engaged, that they broke up their relationship or even their engagement because the questions were so important and provocative and they hadn't thought of it. Hadn't thought of any of those or all of those questions. And then when they discussed it with the person they were dating, they realized this is not the right person for me. Well, here's, you know what? I should write up an answer to your question because you're making me think. One piece of advice does the guy have a track record of stability? Is he stable? If he demonstrates irresponsibility, it's not a good sign. And here's a little test of character that I always have always recommended, and I did it when I was dating. And that is, watch how, and I would say this to a man, watch how the person you're at dinner with treats the waiter or waitress. That's more important, ultimately, than how they are treating you. Obviously, they'll treat you well. They want something from you, a relationship, or sex, or romance, or whatever it might be. But watch how they treat that person. Are they polite to that person? Do they treat that person with dignity? That's the big word for me, more than polite, is dignity. Do they treat them with dignity? And also, talk serious things on a date. You know, your favorite band doesn't tell you anything about a person. Maybe a favorite movie, at least, might perhaps lead to some deeper discussion. But talk deep things. Tell a guy you're dating, you are interested in marriage. Not you're interested in him for marriage, necessarily, but that is important to you. Is it important to you? Ask. These are some of the dates. Another thing that I would suggest, I'm a big believer in internet match services. I don't know how you're going to meet. How are you going to have a selection of so many people without the internet? What are you going to do? You know, walk around a stadium and see who's your age and single. I don't see anything wrong with it. It's not undignified. It's unbelievably safe. And you know, through email or even the phone, you get a chance to before you even meet to find out, is this person the real deal? I mean, it's not foolproof, but it's helpful. Peter. Dennis, 2 questions. What is your best argument for whether or not there's a God? And why do you believe there's no good or evil if God does not exist? Okay, well, they're 2 separate questions. Best argument for whether or not there is a God? You. You're the best argument. Your existence. The existence of me. The existence of everything around us. I asked Charles Krauthammer, who, by the way, will be with me at the Prager University Summit in about 10 days, where we have our annual weekend retreat. And Charles Krauthammer is probably the best-known public conservative commentator. And he is an agnostic. So I had him on my show last year, I think. And I didn't ask him, I think, 1 question about politics. If you want to hear Charles Krauthammer or read Charles Krauthammer on politics, you don't need me. I'd like to ask people other questions. So I asked him what he thought of atheism. And I had no idea what he would say, because he's not religious. But I'm now paraphrasing. In effect, he said, it was the most irrational position he had ever encountered. He couldn't stop saying how dumb the idea of atheism is, how intellectually empty. He said, you telling me that everything came about on its own, that's rational? This is all here on its own? And that's to me is the obvious answer to your question. I mean, I give you a dozen other ones, but just that alone, the fact that we're here, that I'm talking to you, that there's consciousness. Science has no clue where consciousness comes from. Do you know that? No clue. How do you know you're you? Where does that come from? Okay, and the other one was, why do you believe that there's no good or evil if God does not exist? I don't believe that. That I know. I believe there is a God. I can't say I know there's a God. I believe there's a God. But this one is not a matter of belief. If there's no God, the only thing that exists is matter or material. Materialism is the only option if there is no God. Everything that exists is a physical thing, right? Atoms are physical, molecules, mountains, rivers, you, me, everything is physical. But good and evil are concepts. They're not physical. They don't exist. They don't objectively exist. Where is good and evil? Hello? Where is it? Can I measure it? Can I see it? Of course not. Good and evil, if there is no God, is an opinion. You think that visiting the sick is good? The next guy thinks that cheating his company is good. Who's to say what's good? It's an opinion. Opinions about good and evil exist if there is no God. But good and evil don't exist if there is no God. All the responses I saw on the internet, and God, it was filled. People made videos attacking my video for Prager University on that whole question about if there is no God, how do you know murder is wrong? If there is no God, is murder wrong? I think that was is that the title of it? I think that it is. And they all missed the point. It's fascinating. I debated serious professors on this issue. They all acknowledged, atheists, if there's no God, there is no good and evil. They're just opinions of good and evil. It's subjective. It's the amateurs answering me on the internet who think that they have an answer. But there is no answer. Brianna. Hi, Brianna. Dennis, what's your favorite book of the Bible, and who's your favorite character in the Bible? You know, I always think I've been asked every question possible, and I'm not sure I was ever asked my favorite book. My favorite book. I know my favorite five books, the first five, known as the Torah, and I've been teaching that for 35 years from the Hebrew, coming out in 2.5 years with a 2,000-page commentary explaining those great five books. So I don't have one favorite. I have five favorite. And of the five, let's see. Genesis is great, obviously, but it's not my favorite. It's not lesser. Exodus is great because of the Exodus and the plagues. The beginning, the first half of both of those books are great. The second half are fine, but Genesis may be the richest. But believe it or not, Numbers, the fourth book, is relentlessly interesting. Relentlessly. And who's my favorite character in the Bible? Whoa. My favorite character. Believe it or not, you ready? This is what came to my mind. I'm not saying if I thought about it at length, this would be my answer. Off the top of my head, my favorite are the two female, what do you call them? In Hebrew, mialdot. What is it in English? The girls who midwives? The midwives, yeah. The two Egyptian midwives who said no to Pharaoh when he said, whenever an Israelite woman gives birth, kill the boy baby. And they said no. Imagine that. Do you know that in ancient Egypt, Pharaoh was a god, not just a pharaoh. And they said no. And it says why? Because the midwives feared God. I have a whole theory on fear of God and why it is essential to life. That's not for now. So oddly enough, that's who came to my mind, even though we know very little about them other than that. But there are a lot of great characters, of course, in the Bible. But that came to mind. Jason asks, hi, Jason. Dennis, what does the Bible say with regard to humans' responsibility to protect the environment? Well, you know, the Bible, it doesn't say something about everything. It gives you guidelines. The Bible does not view nature as benignly as we do in the first world. For all of human history, it was a battle for survival between the human being and nature. So it says that you should, in fact, subdue nature. You should rule over it and subdue it. That it never says abuse it, but subdue it. What do you think fighting cancer is? You're fighting nature. You're subduing nature. Cancer is natural. Heart attacks are natural. We spend our lives fighting nature. Much of human history was spent making sure you weren't devoured by an animal. You know, we're so removed from nature that we think, oh, nature, ah, nature. Yeah, because we take a trip to Yosemite National Park, we go in our car, we're totally safe from the animals and from the weather. We look, we take photos of the most gorgeous scenes in the world, and go back in our car and sleep in a motel that night.
Go on a safari, see what nature's
really. Well, yeah, go on a safari. I've been on three safaris in Kenya, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. And I remember the first one, I was in my 20s. It was a learning experience. The animals basically are divided up, obviously, between those that eat other animals and those that get eaten. That's nature. And they spend all their day protecting themselves, or, in the case of the lions, all their day looking to eat other animals. It's not a pretty picture. It's gorgeous aesthetically, but it's not a pretty picture. I have no romanticization of nature. We should protect the environment insofar as it affects humanity. I don't want dirty air because I don't want to breathe dirty air, and I don't want my children or you to breathe dirty air. I don't want dirty water for the same reason. But other than that, I don't romanticize nature. Antonio asks, Dennis, why do you support the death penalty? Read my essay in my book of essays. I have a book with 44 different essays on 44 subjects. And if reading is still in at all, these are bite-sized chapters. It's like 8 pages a chapter. That's it. So I have about an 8-page essay on why I support the death penalty. In a nutshell, because I can't think of a greater injustice. Shall I repeat myself? I cannot think of a greater injustice than allowing all murderers to live. Some murderers I would allow to live if it's not premeditated, if it's a passion, if it's second degree, third degree, if it's manslaughter. Okay. But when I read, the example I give is these two men who went into the home of a doctor, his wife, and two daughters in Connecticut a few years ago. And let's see, what did they do? They beat the father almost to death with a baseball bat. Then they went and raped the mother and one of the daughters. I think she was 12 at the time. Then they strangled the mother to death. And then they tied the girls on their beds, poured gasoline on the house, and then burned it down while they were still alive. They caught these two men, and those who were against the death penalty have the very strange notion that those guys deserve to live. And as I have said, you can see my video, although we've done a redo, so you'll see it even better when we put it out. But as I always say, those who think that those men deserve to live have both a different heart and a different mind than mine. I admit it. It's an unbridgeable gulf. If you think they deserve to live, I really have nothing to say to you, because our hearts feel differently and our minds think differently. Xavier.
Hi, Xavier. Dennis.
Can you explain how Judaism and Christianity differ in terms of how someone gets into heaven? The traditional Christian view is that you get into heaven through faith in Christ and living by Christ's teachings. Because, you know, the notion that a lot of non-Christians have, that if you believe in Christ, you can do anything you want, you can then go out, rape and murder, and you'll still get to heaven, is not normative Christian view. Because if you go out, rape and murder, the belief among serious Christians is, well, you really don't believe in Christ. If you did, you wouldn't do that. But nevertheless, it is still faith-based how you get into heaven. Judaism is behavior-based. Good people of any faith or atheists can get into heaven if they act good. So yes, the Jewish view is you earn your way into heaven, and the Christian view is you don't earn your way into heaven. And that's the traditional difference. Summer asked, Dennis, if you don't believe in multiculturalism, why do you believe in learning other languages? Well, perhaps, I think, Summer, your understanding of multiculturalism is different from what it's meant. Multiculturalism doesn't mean love of many cultures. I love many cultures. I've been to 130 countries because I love immersing myself in other people's lives and the way they live. I have been abroad every year of my life since I was 20. And included half of that time, I had very little money, but I always devoted money to travel. I love studying and visiting other cultures. But I don't believe, and this is what multiculturalism believes. Multiculturalism believes that all cultures are morally equivalent. That's the end of civilization, that belief. Okay? It's nonsense and it's dangerous. That's multiculturalism, that all you can't judge. And the other is that America should be a multicultural country. Now, America is multi-ethnic, multi-racial, but it has not been multicultural in the sense that it has had a dominant culture. It has had an American culture, which consists of what I call the American Trinity. It's on every one of your coins or banknotes. Liberty, in God we trust, e pluribus unum, from many one. From many one, not from many, many. So that's why, I have problems with multiculturalism. Not because I have a problem with other cultures or studying other cultures or respecting them. Two more questions. Mark. Hi, Mark. Dennis, do you think for pragmatic reasons that conservatives have to engage in political boycotts the way the left does? Well, that's a tough one. I always use the example of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. I think Ben and Jerry are dummies. If they said it was raining outside, I would assume the sun is shining. Because they have such radical views, which are not thought through, in my opinion. They're just felt. Nevertheless, I buy Ben and Jerry's ice cream because I believe in a free market. If you make good ice cream, even if you are a fool, I will eat your ice cream. Because I'm not judging you when I eat your ice cream. I'm judging your ice cream. The left has ended that practice. If they don't like what you stand for, they want you out of business. It's another disgusting aspect of the left. Everything about the left ultimately is poisonous. Not liberals, the left. And that's another example of it. So Chick-fil-A, they didn't agree that the owner of Chick-fil-A thought that marriage should remain between a man and a woman. For that alone, it was enough for the mayor of New York and the mayor of Boston to say Chick-fil-A is not welcome in our city. Imagine a conservative mayor saying Ben and Jerry's is not welcome in our city. So we don't act that way. However, there are occasions. for example, I wish that conservatives didn't let their kids watch MTV. I wish liberals didn't let their kids watch MTV. It's a terrible network. It has done a lot of damage to American life, that network, to the minds of young people and to their value system. But other than that, I generally abstain from the boycott route. Final question. Robert asks, Dennis, what speakers do you have for your stereo? Robert, I love you. Now, that's a question that brings a smile to my face. Music, as I said, is a very deep part of my life, so I, of course, have a very, very good music system, so I can hear music in my home almost like I would hear it at a live concert. In my case right now, I have the speakers, they're YG. You could look it up if you're not familiar with it. They're really stupendous. They're not the only stupendous speakers, but I love them, and the price point that I paid, I thought they were superior. And I guess that really does it, doesn't it, guys? So with that, I just want to tell you what a joy it is for me to be with you almost every week from my home. Don't forget to visit Prager University and watch our videos. And try to catch my radio show wherever you are in the world, on the internet, if it's outside of the U.S., local station or internet inside the U.S., and what else? That's pretty much it for now. Thanks for watching. See you next week.